Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news, but stand by now for the Worldview. It is the Weekly Worldview. I am your host, Doug McBurney, joined in studio today by my extreme audio engineer. So glad to have you aboard on the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. We're going to begin today in India. I said, that's right. This is from the Telegraph over in London. There's a court in India who's been asked to rule on whether a Hindu guru is dead or just deep in meditation. Yes, the family and followers of one of India's wealthiest Hindu spiritual leaders are fighting a legal battle over whether he is dead or simply in a deep state of meditation. His Holiness Sri Ashutosh Maharaj, you know him, the founder of the Divya Jyoti Jagrati Sansthan religious order. We're all familiar with them. I think the Beatles... Isn't that the same group that George Harrison? Maybe a different group? Similar number of vowels? Perhaps. Anyway, His Holiness has a property estate worth about $120 million. And according to his wife and son, he died back in January. However, his disciples at his ashram have refused to let the family take his body for cremation because they claim he's still alive. Yes, they say he simply went into a deep samadhi. Yes, or a meditation. And the members of the ashram has frozen his body to preserve it for when he awakens from his meditation. Yes, his body is currently contained in a commercial freezer at the ashram. Kind of a low-tech, you know. But, you know, they're getting the job done. They're keeping him frozen until he wakes up. Now, Punjab police initially confirmed that he had died, but the Punjab High Court later dismissed its status report, and local governmental officials said it was a spiritual matter that the guru's followers cannot be forced to believe that he is dead. So the court rules that the guru's followers, we just cannot force them to believe that he is dead because, well, you know, in Hinduism, Vishnu created everything and Vishnu created nothing and everything is nothing and nothing is everything. So perhaps he is not dead. Perhaps he is just meditating and we can still keep spending his bank account. Yes, yes, for trips and cars and things like this for the ashram, of course. His son claims that his late father's followers are refusing to release his body as a means of retaining control of his vast financial empire. Gee, you think? Anyway, that's pretty wild. That's from the Bad Religion file right off the top. We open with Bad Religion, and it just gets worse from there. As far as religion goes, we'll get into a lot of that. But I want to comment on the story from the War file. Apparently, Barry Ho has exchanged five of Al-Qaeda's top lieutenants, maybe even generals, for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, a story we've commented on the past, we've commented upon in the past. We have shamed the Obama administration for his abandonment of soldiers, Marines, airmen, sailors like Bo Bergdahl. And so Barry is in such a weak state that apparently he has made the deal to release Mohammed Fazl, the Al-Qaeda's former deputy minister, Abdul Haq Wasiq, former deputy military minister of intelligence for the Taliban. Who's the I there? This is difficult. Khairullah, former heroin trafficker and Taliban governor of Herat, and Narullah Nuri, who was personally asked by Osama bin Laden to participate in the northern drug wars. So Barry is now dealing with terrorists, and it's a 5-for-1 exchange for the Taliban. Did I say Al-Qaeda? I apologize. I meant the Taliban. It's a 5-for-1. They get 5 of their top generals in exchange for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. And, of course, we're very happy that Sergeant Bo Bergdahl has been released. We're happy for his family and all of that. But I've got to tell you that dealing with terrorists in this manner, to me, indicates extreme weakness. And, again, buttresses my argument that the United States, the Allied powers, indeed have lost the war in Afghanistan and are on the verge of handing the country back over to the same group of fanatical Nazi Islamists that we initially attacked after 9/11, and the war has been lost by George W. Bush primarily, but Barry Ho coming in, bringing up the rear to finish the job in America's first loss of its first war of the 21st century. Thank you very much, Mr. Bush. Thank you very much, Mr. Obama. You're an embarrassment. You should both be banished to outer darkness where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. Pathetic. Now, on a better note, Miriam Ibrahim, the Christian woman who recently gave birth in prison, was she in Pakistan? Was that Pakistan where she's being held? Well, I don't have it right here in front of me. It's one of those Islamist countries. I believe it was Pakistan. Well, there's a report from a governing official there that she is to be released within weeks, perhaps days. And as best we can tell, her release will be at the behest of Tony Blair and David Cameron, British politicians. Said the State Department apparently was never even aware that there was a controversy. No one at the State Department had anything to say except just boilerplate commentary, but apparently Miriam Ibrahim, who's in prison right now with her newborn and her toddler son, while her American husband awaits her fate, she had been sentenced to death, as you know. Well, apparently, Tony Rock and Roll Blair and David Cameron over in London have pressed upon the Islamist government, whichever one it is that holds her. And you know who it is. You know who you are. And Barry can take no credit for that, but he will get all the credit for allowing 5 of the Taliban's top generals to be released from Guantanamo. Now, they should have been executed within a year of their capture, I think, after we bled them for all the information we could get. They should have all been executed. Guantanamo should have been closed years ago because everyone should have been dead. But that has not taken place. Instead, we choose to follow just a ridiculous series of judicial acrobatics, stupidity, brought to you by the proctocracy that apparently runs the military as well as the government, both state, local, and federal, for good measure. The proctocracy rules them all, and they apparently rule in the military as well, and that's just sad as we're engaged in this battle against the Islamists. Speaking of court, as part of the McBurney compound homeschool curriculum this past week, our students attended a courtroom proceeding here in the state of Colorado. If I'm not mistaken, they attended a bond hearing for an alleged burglar. Now, he had tattoos on his neck and had been accused of burgling and scaring and otherwise harassing people. And at some point, he had cut off his GPS monitor and thrown it in the dumpster. And so the judge was asked to decide whether or not his bond should be revoked and he should be tossed back in jail. And it was a long, long proceeding. Now, one would assume that if a guy comes in with tattoos on his neck and there's credible evidence from a number of witnesses that he tore off his GPS monitoring device and threw it in the dumpster, that the hearing would last about 3 minutes and that the judge would revoke his bond and throw him back in the hole. But this thing went on and on and on. In fact, it went on for so long that the courtroom stenographer, lovely young lady, you know, sitting there typing away as the proceedings go, she was asleep. Her eyes were closed, her mouth gaped open, her head tilted back, yet she kept on typing. It was amazing to watch. It was She obviously had acquired skills to which many other stenographers aspire, but perhaps never read. She slept for a goodly segment of the proceeding and never stopped typing the whole time. My assistant professor at the McBurney School elbowed me. She's pointing at this lady. It was either a very impressive display of stenographer skills, or it was an example of how useless the position of a stenographer is at this point. My guess is that she's developed the skill to somehow insert a cue to let herself know later that that's when she went to sleep. And then she listens to the tapes in the evening and types it all back in. It was quite the scene to watch. But the courtrooms have become so ridiculous, ludicrous, and outrageous that we had to bring our children down to show them that the fate of the country is in the hands of fools and children. And so they did get a chance to learn that. And, unfortunately, they got to see a real live criminal close up, which, well, we wish that hadn't happened. But they were turned off and creeped out by the tattoos. That's one thing we have instilled in the girls, is a revulsion to tattoos and body piercing. We hope that lasts them their lifetime. Now, before we go on into the we want to get into the science file. Should I save these, or these are such deep scientific stories? I don't think I can jump into these, so I'm gonna postpone the science file for just a moment, and instead, we're gonna talk about the culture. We go into the culture file this week, a story from Fox News New York. Actually, this is an AP story. Event planners, bakers, lawyers, and academics note the rise of divorce parties. Divorce parties, yes. Over the last several years, there's been a marked increase with many cakes featuring weapon-wielding brides, and black frosting, and other dark and macabre themes. One marketing professor at Golden Gate University in San Francisco sees divorce parties as part of a larger trend in celebrations. Yes, the marketing professor at Golden State University says people are also celebrating coming out to their parents or coworkers and the birthdays of their pets. There's just been an enormous increase in the variety of things that Americans celebrate. And divorce is just one of those along the spectrum of things to celebrate. One man who lives outside Austin, Texas, marked his amicable split with a party co-hosted by his ex that included gluten-free cake. Of course, gluten-free cake, even for the divorce crowd. Gluten-free is it, whether you're married or divorced. This man who had a big old party with a gluten-free cake to celebrate his divorce is the father of three boys. And he says the party offered closure, especially important because kids were involved. Kids were involved, he said. A little Freudian slip there. Yes, I'm sorry. If you divorce and you have this, and you're still happy enough with each other to have a party at which both of you pay for some of the accoutrement of the party, You're guilty of abandoning your children and your pathetic examples of civilization. And it's child abuse, and I'm disgusted by it. There. He says, we wanted to do something that expressed the fact that we were doing the divorce not so much as an end of our relationship, but to moving on to things like co-parenting. Co-parenting. Don't feel bad, boys. Mom and Dad are going to be co-parents. Everything's fine. Have a piece of gluten-free cake. Pathetic. This is the example that adults give to children now. One cake designer says, I really think it's a healthy thing, divorce parties. When my sister got divorced 25 years ago, she and my mother went into mourning. Divorce was so embarrassing in those days. just so embarrassing. Way back then in the Stone Age. Let's see. I have a quote here from a family law attorney from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And she sees the divorce cake and the parties as a fresh take on closure. It's a fresh take on closure. All the hard work and emotions are over with, says the family law attorney who foisted all the hard work and emotions upon the couple, turned them against each other, set them at war with one another, destroyed the lives of their children, and now she says, let's have a party that all that's over. Another New York event planner says that parties that include cakes with the wife pushing the husband off the top tier, she calls them freedom cakes. It's all about freedom, that's right. And this event planner is apparently planning and executing divorce parties on a regular basis. He says, this is something you don't have to regret, like the wedding. It's something without any shame. Something without any shame. So no-fault divorce, what, about 40 years ago, no-fault divorce was first legalized? And now divorce has become something without any shame? Even something to be celebrated? Something where we can buy each other a cake and have a party and wave goodbye to the kids? And the last thing anyone wants to think about is anything at all to do with shame.
All right now! Let's go!
Those people who, well, they tell you, well, yeah, we're divorced, but we still get along famously. As if that's supposed to impress anyone. I always think, well, if you still get along famously, why have you destroyed your marriage and injured irreparably the lives of your children? And you smile about it. Anyway, divorce is horrible, ugly disaster. That's what it is. It's an incredible failure, probably the biggest failure anyone can participate in their life. And one of the most effective ways of healing from the tragic consequences of divorce is to admit what it is. And don't buy a cake and throw a party, you moron. You should be in grieving. You should be wearing black. It's a disaster. Anyway. And speaking of domestic tranquility, got a report here from Breitbart's Big Government page regarding the relationship that the Santa Barbara University murderer had with his parents. He wrote in his manifesto that his mother told him that his father and her were getting a divorce. And he writes that he was absolutely shocked, outraged. It was a very sad day. He wrote, all the happy times I spent with my mother and father as a family were gone. So he was 7 years old when his parents divorced. Starting at about age 8, the murderer began undergoing therapy. Was put on various medications, as you can well imagine. During high school, he saw a therapist reportedly pretty much every day. And in the days and weeks before the murder, he was seeing two therapists. Reportedly, he hated his stepmother and his stepbrother and had apparently planned to kill them. He says of his stepmother, I realized that this woman was, in fact, my father's girlfriend, and they were together, just like how my father and mother were together. It was the first time I had learned the concept of a girlfriend, and it was hard to grasp. Before that, I always thought a man and a woman had to be married before living together in such a manner. Isn't that amazing? As a 7 or 8 year old kid, growing up in what I assume would be a secular, godless, hedonistic household of a Hollywood producer, director, what was this guy? Director. I would assume that that the kid was not raised in the fear and admonition of the Lord. But even he knew that a man and a woman had to be married before they lived together. And so when the mother and father divorce, the girlfriend is introduced, later the stepmother is introduced, the kid ends up very confused and all screwed up 6 ways to Sunday because his mother and father chose to be selfish and to destroy their marriage and to irreparably injure the psyche of their child. The Rogers, the parents of the Santa Barbara murderer, are, according to friends, are crippled with guilt. They're grieving for the innocents who lost their lives above their own son. They're absolutely crippled by grief. They're not throwing a party. They're not buying each other a slice of gluten-free cake at the Roger household in light of the destruction that has been wrought in the wake of their selfish divorce. And I do want to mention, and this is something I hadn't even thought of because it had been so long, but do you remember David Attias? Does anyone remember David Attias? February 23rd, 2001, then University of California, Santa Barbara freshman, and son of director Daniel Attias, young David Attias plowed his turbocharged Saab into a group of young adults in the same Isla Vista neighborhood that this recent mass murder took place in. He killed 4 people and permanently injured another before climbing atop the car and declaring himself the Angel of Death. I know. This story was on Michael Savage's webpage. I didn't see it anywhere else, but it reminded me of this story. I remember this story because it shocked the nation. David Attias in 2001 was charged with murder, but was found not guilty by reason of insanity and sent to a state mental institution. David Attias was released in 2012. And is apparently some kind of free man. He may have a GPS ankle bracelet, some sort of control. Judge who released him says that if he goes into remission, he could be sent back to the state mental hospital. But history repeats itself in an ugly and sinister way out in Isla Vista, Santa Barbara, beautiful part of the country. It's so tragic to see the fruit of the secular no-fault divorce tree. The fruit reproduces out there on the West Coast. Very, very sad stories. But they should be a shocking wake-up call to everyone. Fortunately, I don't need to be awakened. I already know all this. What I'm trying to do is shake the nation. I'm grabbing the nation by their collective lapels and trying to shake them awake to the insanity of no-fault divorce, the insanity of a proctocracy that insists we must tolerate insane murderers, rehabilitate them, set them free, that we must tolerate a certain level of murder and mayhem and bloodshed in our midst. Who is it that made all this up and convinced us that we had to tolerate this? It was the proctocracy, and it was only made possible by the pastors in the Christian churches being stifled and shutting their mouths and sitting on their hands and insisting that Jesus loves everyone and we just need to love and forgive. Stay inside of our churches. Just pathetic. Just pathetic. If the pastors would stand up and speak the truth, even just once a week on Sundays, we could have a huge impact on the culture. But instead, the church has been cowed. Well, it's been infiltrated primarily by the godless. And so there's very little hope that we turn this thing around. Without having to be on the other side of some other catastrophic event. So let's move from the culture, which is getting depressing. We'll move on to the science. Really? File. Yes, this is from Time Magazine. Time Magazine, this past week, has a cover that says the transgender tipping point. Yeah, and it has a picture of a she-male on the front. And I must admit that I clicked the story, but then Time had a paywall. So you have to pay to get a subscription to Time before you can read the story about the next civil rights battle, which is going to be for the transgendered. And it was the first time I was ever thankful to hit a paywall. And I clicked and I closed the window and I didn't go into the whole... Now, but you know it's true, right? The next civil rights battle will be... Well, it's either going to be for the trannies or for the polygamists. That's all coming. Coming to a town near you. But we go to Time Magazine for the Science, Really? File. Time reports that it was just weeks ago that astronomers announced a major double-barreled discovery. Using a super-sensitive microwave telescope known as BICEP 2, they had seen evidence of gravity waves that roiled the cosmos before it was a billionth of a trillionth of a second old. Yes, that was part one. Part two was that the observed gravity waves strongly confirmed the theory of cosmic inflation. That the entire universe went into warp overdrive, expanding faster than the speed of light for the tiniest fraction of a second. Yes, big, big discovery. Yes, cosmic inflation confirmed by BICEP 2 just a few weeks ago. Well, the signal may still be from the dawn of time, writes Princeton University astrophysicist David Spergel. Yes, David Spergel of Princeton. But he says it might equally be just schmutz. Yes, schmutz. Yeah, I know. This is an astrophysicist, a university professor at Princeton. He says it could be from the beginning of time. It could just be schmutz. You know schmutz, right? Schmutz is the Yiddish term used by Jewish mothers to identify that you've got some kind of stuff on your face. When they rub their face, they say, you got some schmutz there. Rub that off, little Johnny. Anyway, he says it might be the dawn of time. It might be schmutz. And he says, at this point, I'm convinced that they haven't made a discovery at all. It's not that anyone doubted the integrity or ability of the Harvard-led team that claimed the discovery. Mr. Schmutz says that these guys are no slouches. This is a good group. But if there's a problem, it's one of enthusiasm. They were a little overly enthusiastic about peering back into the dawn of time, and they ended up with some schmutz on their face because their theory is, pretty crackpot. Time Magazine reports that the theory of inflation seemed downright nutty when it was first proposed in the early 1980s by a professor at MIT, but it did explain some of the mysteries that had stumped astrophysicists for decades, including why the universe looks essentially the same in all directions and why galaxies and clusters of galaxies are distributed in the way they are. You see, ladies and gentlemen, in the Big Bang, old Earth universe, there's just things that don't make any sense at all. And so physicists and quantum physicists and theoretical physicists, emphasis on the theoretical, have tried jumping through hoops to figure out theories like cosmic inflation to explain the fact that the Big Bang doesn't work mathematically. And they've been jumping through hoops for decades trying to figure it out. Well, this morning at Denver Bible Church, we were given a preview of Bob Enyart's latest masterwork, perhaps the biggest secular work he's ever worked on, at least I shouldn't say purely secular, but scientific work, let's say that. The global flood and the hydroplate theory is a 3-CD set, 3-DVD set. It's going to be really good. It's all about Walt Brown's hydroplate theory. And I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about the other theory that physicists like Bob Enyart who's a fundamentalist Bible preacher. A theory that they've come up with to challenge cosmic inflation, the Big Bang, and all that. I don't think I'm allowed to talk about that. But I do want to encourage all of you to go to KGOV.com and pre-order a copy of Noah's Flood and the Hydroplate Theory, a powerhouse seminar that explains a lot of the terrestrial evidence against the Big Bang and for a young Earth, and of course, special creation by God the Father. And then once you get all and you soak all that in, just be prepared for a theory that challenges cosmic inflation and the Big Bang, coming from fundamentalist Bible preacher Bob Enyart in Denver. Yep. Is there anything else on the cosmic deflation theory over there at Time Magazine? No. A host of ground-based and balloon-based microwave telescopes are with BICEP2 to look for evidence of gravity waves themselves. And according to researchers, further research is definitely needed. Further research to establish cosmic inflation is certainly needed. That's from some of the brightest minds in the universe who are still trying to explain a universe without God. And I am your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. Had to go back and check my notes. The name of the seminar is The Global Flood and the Hydroplate Theory, featuring Bob Enyart and his analysis of the global flood and Walt Brown's Hydroplate Theory that explains an awful lot. Definitely worth checking into. Pre-order a copy today over at KGOV.com. I tried to get my hands on the DVD, but it was absconded with by someone else in the church congregation. Hoping to get a chance to look at it this coming week, and we'll have a review of it here at the Worldview in the not-too-distant future. Now we move on deeper into the science file, but this is the science really file. This is from theweek.com, theweek.com, and it's a story about abortion and liberals. Abortion and liberals, a topic often covered here at the Worldview. The author notes that science does not inform us when human life begins. Isn't that interesting? Science really doesn't inform us. It can give us all the facts. It can give us all the data points. But it doesn't really reveal the answer. The answer really depends on your worldview. And yes, your position on abortion will determine your analysis of the facts. The data points are the same for everybody, but depending on your worldview, you'll come to the conclusion that it's okay to abort an innocent child. Or if you have my worldview, you come to the conclusion that it's an abomination and that you're murdering an innocent child. But it all depends on your worldview, because science indeed, as the Week reports, does not inform us as to when human life begins. And the presence of biological life should inform our idea of personhood. Life begins at conception, and that is a scientific fact. That's a statement that was made by Marco Rubio, a Republican. He was roundly criticized for asserting that there could be anything like a scientific fact around the question of when human life begins. Now, as far as a 65 million year old dinosaur with soft tissue in its bones, well, you can't question those facts. But to assert that anyone could assume that they know a fact surrounding the beginning of human life, well, he was a laughingstock when he said that. And The Week reports that there are two stock responses to the statement that life begins at conception. And they report that both are obscurantist. Yes, designed to obscure, not to clarify. Philip Bump promised to... Who is Philip Bump, by the way? Well, he's a blogger. That's all I've got on the guy. Maybe he's somebody. Maybe I just never heard of him. It's quite possible. There's lots of people I never heard of. But Philip Bump promised, famously and boldly, to look into the science of human life's origins and to boldly come back saying that there isn't any. Well, after querying a medical definition of pregnancy, Bump threw up his hands and retreated from the science altogether, asserting that life is something of a philosophical question, certainly not a scientific question. It's a question which it hardly bears mentioning. Says The Week, this question is an argument that's actually about abortion. And that really is the bottom line when we discuss when human life begins. Rarely are we having a purely academic argument. What we're actually talking about is the question of abortion. The Week article goes on, if someone were to argue that life begins at implantation, which is what the American Board of Obstetrics and Gynecology says. They say that life begins at implantation. Fertilization occurs, a zygote, a blastocyst is produced, a zygote develops, travels down the fallopian tube into the uterus, and then implants sometime in the days and weeks after fertilization. So the National OBGYN Society says that's when pregnancy begins, so that must be when life begins. Well, if someone would argue that life begins at implantation, well, then it is hard to find a moral argument against forms of birth control that prevent implantation from happening. Yeah. The aforementioned Philip Bump takes the currently unresolved debate about legal personhood and simply transposes it onto the facts of biology after a half-hearted gesture at investigation. His entire argument, what is human life anyway, can we really know, amounts to a pose of humble sophistication that amounts to saying, I don't know where babies come from. How can we know? I mean, we think we know. I don't know where babies come from. Which is the insanity that ensues when one focuses solely on a set of facts designed to disprove one's own moral responsibility for anything, which is what Mr. Bump engaged in. Now, the article goes on, the science is actually pretty straightforward. After the fusion of a sperm and egg, the resulting zygote has unique human DNA from which we can deduce the identity of its biological parents. It has a metabolic action that will not end until it dies. Whether that is in a few days because it never implants, or years later in a gruesome fishing accident, or a century later in a hospital room filled with beloved grandchildren. That is a profound paragraph that simply cannot be disputed on any side of the argument. It's simple truth, and the science is pretty straightforward. Now, in the case of identical twins, because this is a big question that I get from some of the pro-aborts, in the case of identical twins, the zygote divides and two separate metabolic processes begin using the same genetic code. This is an observed phenomenon. Hand-waving about whether we categorize viruses as life, for example, doesn't obtrude on these facts, since human zygotes cannot develop into viruses or non-human forms of life. Biology doesn't really give us options for when an individual life begins, at least none that we could deny without also denying our ability to know whether any individual member of any species really exists. And the sad thing is there are academics and professors who are willing to admit that they don't know if anything really exists in order to hold on to this set of facts designed to absolve them from any moral responsibility, especially when it comes to the life of the innocent and their responsibility toward their neighbor. The article continues, the second stock response is to nonchalantly acknowledge that human life does begin at conception, but to say that this is a distraction. This whole argument is a distraction, or at least it has no bearing on how we should think about legal abortion. Another blogger, Ryan Cooper, writes that he is, quote, fine with the idea that an abortion presents the end of a life, which I distinguish from the idea of a human being. And he continues, the point is that science has little to do with this argument. Science has enormous cultural legitimacy. So I can see why people want to claim it for their own position or try to quibble with the definition of life. But when it comes to abortion, science simply doesn't have much to say. Well, the author of the article says, but of course, it's not just the cultural legitimacy of science that anti-abortion activists and writers want to evoke. The very existence of the first argument that we cannot know when life begins testifies to the fact that many people are not at all fine with the idea that an abortion represents the end of life. Many are, in fact, uncomfortable with the idea of having to categorize, with the idea of having a category of human life that is not granted the status of humanity. When anti-abortion activists say that human life begins at conception, anti-abortion advocates see themselves as advocates of a reality-based community, and so they show little patience with arguments that we can generate our own private meaning about when life begins. And that's the difference between the pro-aborts and the abolitionists, is that we don't want to construct our own set of facts that absolve us of moral responsibility. We want to deal in reality. What's real and what's the truth? We want to know the truth, and we want to strive for that. We don't want to know ourselves and strive to exalt ourselves above the truth. But that is not the point of view of a murderer. And that's what a pro-abortion advocate is. A pro-abortion advocate is a murderer. And a murderer seeks to exalt his right to kill above the truth. Okay, I think that's all I've got. That was excerpted in the New York Times from the week. Excerpted in the week.com from the New York Times. And basically, it's all about your worldview. And that's how you'll see the facts. And that's how you'll interpret things. Speaking of that, I've got a set of facts here that I downloaded from CNN. Members of a Northeast Georgia SWAT team, made up of six officers, entered a residence last Wednesday just before 3 a.m. A confidential informant had purchased methamphetamine hours earlier at the house. The informant told police that they were armed men or men standing guard outside the house. Perhaps they were armed. Now, because the suspected drug dealer had a previous weapons charge, officers were issued a no-knock warrant. When the SWAT team hit the home's front door with a battering ram, the door resisted, as if something were up against it. So one of the officers threw a flashbang grenade inside the residence. Once inside the house, the SWAT team realized that it was a portable playpen that was blocking the door, and the flashbang grenade had landed inside the playpen where a 19-month-old baby was sleeping. The baby was horribly injured, terribly, terribly injured. And I listened to several commentators over this past week decrying no-knock warrants and decrying the actions of the police as irresponsible, second-guessing and questioning. And I've heard the police roundly criticized on a number of outlets. And I don't know the ins and outs of their training and their policies. But it's not the police I blame for this horrible injury of this child. This child will have a lifetime of surgeries and reconstructions. The child's face was basically blown or burned off by this grenade. But I say it's the governor of the state of Georgia and the legislature on down through every lawyer who has helped build this industry around the tolerance of hard drugs that actually is more responsible for the injury to this innocent child than any one of the police on that SWAT team. You lawyers who have convinced, and you politicians and you judges, you filthy heathens who've convinced us that we have to tolerate a culture of violence and hard drugs, and you tie the hands of the police, and when the police are out there on the front lines fighting, now everyone gets upset. When it's the governor whose house should be stormed with pitchforks and torches, and every legislator's house should be stormed, and every lawyer and every judge, all the way down, should be held accountable for building this industry in which they make a handsome living and in which the innocent are constantly put in harm because they have decided we must tolerate a certain level of violence, bloodshed, and hard drugs. These filthy lawyers have put the police in the unfortunate position of being their muscle. I'm your host, Doug McBurney, joined in studio today, as always, by my track audio engineer, bringing you the sights and sounds of a world gone mad, but we remain tethered to the truth of the Creator and the Savior of the world. That's right, and we're reaching out, offering you a tether. I mentioned that the cover of Time magazine earlier in the broadcast. Well, here it comes, folks, and it's an avalanche. My extremely attractive audio engineer may have to leave the studio because we're about to quote Orrin Hatch, and that's not the worst of it. From the Culture File, Salt Lake City, from the Associated Press, Utah Senator Orrin Hatch conceded this past week that it's only a matter of time before homosexual marriage is legal across the country, even though he doesn't think it's the right way to go. Hatch said, "People who can't see what's happening aren't living in the real world." So, Orrin Hatch confirming my suspicion that this topic is the number one administration agenda of not only Barry Ho, but every other proctor and deviant liberal who runs every little corner and crevice and cavity of the federal, state, and local governments. The homosexualization of the nation is the number one imperative mission that these bastards are on. And Hatch tells us that it's simply inevitable. He said he doesn't agree with the string of pro-gay marriage rulings, but defended the Utah judges who issued the decisions. Why? Because he's a part of the proctocracy. And he worships the law, and especially lawyers. Why? Because he is a lawyer. He's a filthy, disgusting, foul, vile lawyer. He says the decisions are, he may hold that they're immoral and destructive and even evil, but he will defend the judges who issued the decisions. Why? Because they did it all by the book. He says they're excellent federal judges. He recommended both for the bench. He says, how can you blame the judge for deciding a case in accordance with what the Supreme Court has already articulated? Of course you can own those slaves. The Supreme Court has already... we can't... Do you realize where that argument goes, Mr. Hatch? Maybe. No, he doesn't. Filthy, disgusting, vile lawyer. The story goes on to write how many court cases the homosexuals have won recently. Hatch says he believes nobody should suffer discrimination, and he said religious people should try to understand other people's beliefs. Hey, if other people want to corrupt and destroy your children, you should understand that. Hey, it's a part of the fabric of America to tolerate the violation, the deflowering, the molestation of our children, the public molestation that's going on every day. You can't hardly take your kids out in public anymore without their minds being molested by the filth that walks around and talks. It's just disgusting. They can't watch TV, can't watch broadcast TV, can't watch the news with your kids. Growing up, I remember some of the best the best times of my very young life was sitting in the living room watching Walter Cronkite with my father, and my father would explain to me the news of the day. And you well, that's 1970s-ish, 1970s, early 70s. Well, you can't do that anymore. You can't sit down and watch the news with your children. Not if they're innocent, not if they're young. What else does Hatch? Hatch said, I don't think that homosexual marriage is the right way to go. But on the other hand, I do accept whatever the courts have to say. Sieg Heil! Says Orrin Hatch. The National Park Service. The Associated Press reports that the National Park Service has a critical new initiative. The secretary reports that he's convening a panel of scholars that'll be charged with exploring the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender movement story in areas such as law, religion, media, civil rights, and the arts. The committee will identify sites, and its work will be used to evaluate them for inclusion on the National Register of Historic Places. That's right. These sites like the bathroom at the Stonewall Inn could be designated as National Historic Landmarks. That's right. The Secretary of the Interior says that it's important that the places we recognize represent the full complement of the American experience. The full complement! That's right, including the queers. That's, of course. In fact, isn't that the most important compliment? If you don't say it's the most important compliment, well, you're going to pay. The baker out in Lakewood, by the way, I can't remember the name of his outfit. It's escaping me at the moment. I don't have the story. There is a baker here in Colorado who refused to bake a cake for a homosexual wedding. He's now been ordered by the state to bake cakes for homosexuals. On the radio earlier this week, I heard him say, you know, I just don't do cakes anymore. He said, because of all the publicity, I'm busy selling other baked goods, and I simply do not offer wedding cake services at all anymore. That's his out, or at least it is for the moment. But if the homos show up on his door and demand a cake, perhaps the state will come in and say, look, even though you only make cookies now, you're going to bake them a cake. Damn it. Where was I? Oh, yes, the National Historic Landmarks, like the bathroom at the Stonewall Inn. The process that the secretary has put into place mirrors efforts that the service has already undertaken to promote and preserve locations that reflect the roles of Latinos, Asian Americans, women, and other minorities. See how they lump the homosexuals in with legitimate minorities? I mean, I'd be upset, frankly, being lumped in with a bunch of queers. Standing up saying, look, man, I might be Latino, man, but I don't go for none of that. Come on. Come on, dude. That's disgusting. You kidding me? Anyway, the Park Service Director has announced the initiative at New York Stonewall Inn. That's where they made the announcement, from the men's room at the Stonewall in Greenwich Village, where in 1969, you'll remember, a series of riots took place in which homosexuals threw bottles and burned things down to demand that they be allowed to copulate freely anywhere they choose, especially in front of your children. All right. By the way, the founding of the first American homosexual rights organization was in Chicago in 1924. And by the way, you may not know this, but that founding of that homosexual rights organization was part of a sister organization that was very big in Berlin and in Vienna, Austria, where Adolf Hitler and a number of his minions, especially amongst Ernst Röhm's brown shirts, they were all part of these homosexualist organizations. They had their sister organization in Chicago, and one group ended up founding the Brown Shirts and the Nazi Party, and the rest of them have gone on to take the levers of power here in the United States of America and are well on their way to the utter destruction of our nation, the corruption and defilement of our children, and I will not stand by for it. I will stand up, and I will fight for my kids. Let's see, there's a study now that to find all these historical places like the men's room at the Stonewall Inn and other gay bars. It's being financed by Tim Gill, a homosexual philanthropist who helped to legalize homosexual marriage and marijuana here in Colorado. No surprise there, right? Tim Gill, makes $1 billion making software, and then uses it to destroy the world. A typical homosexual. Suicidal children. Mayor Anise Parker out in Houston, you remember her. We covered her inauguration. She says that Houston's bathrooms, showers, and dressing facilities will now be open to all, regardless of gender, gender identity, gender expression, or other predilection of gender behavior. In fact, she's eliminated the idea of gender at all, apparently. Yeah, it's her, Mayor Anise Parker is Houston's first openly homosexual mayor. We already knew that. She says passing this ordinance may not have been the most important thing she's done while in office, but it is, quote, the most personally meaningful thing I will ever do as mayor, unquote. So this is the mayor of a major metropolitan U.S. city in which life and death decisions are made every day by the political leadership. And what's the one thing that will be the most personally meaningful to Anise Parker is opening up the girls' room to the boys. That's the thing she's most, that has the most personal meaning for her as the mayor of Houston, Texas. Now, the ordinance that Anise Parker eventually signed was opposed by many black pastors. About 150 black pastors angrily walked out of the city council meeting when they were not allowed to speak in turn. And they split. And this reminds me, those of you who are out to save the world, you might want to stop and think about what the Bible says. The Bible says, "Be ye separate. Be ye a holy people unto me." Don't spend all of your time trying to save the world because the world doesn't want to be saved. Focus on saving your own. Lead your spouse, your children, your family members, your immediate circle. Try to lead them to know the Lord and the truth and salvation and heaven and hell and right and wrong. But as far as going out and trying to save the world, well, good luck to you. And God bless you if you're trying. But be ye separate. That's Old King James, by the way. Yeah, Old King James lingo. Be ye separate. Those of you in the homeschool community, to me, those of us, I should say, in the homeschool community, we are the epitome of that that request of Jesus Christ, that we separate ourselves from the world. All right. Now, one more from the culture file here from CNN. The American, here we go. A ruling by the Department of Health and Human Services now gives authority to 15 regional contractors who administer the Medicare program to decide whether Medicare should cover sex change operations. So this is the insidious way in which the proctocracy does its dirty work. The decision has not been made. The Secretary of HHS cannot be held accountable. But what they've done is they've given the authority to regional contractors who administer the Medicaid program to decide whether or not sex change operations will be covered. And of course they will be, little by little, one by one, territory by territory. Medicare will start paying for sex change operations. It begs the obvious question. I thought Medicare was for old people. Are old people still so obsessed with sex in this country now that they think at the age of 71 that it's time for a sex change operation? That's just the bizarro, humorous, kooky, stupid part. Then there's the utterly immoral and damnable part of the whole thing, for which these politicians should be held to the ultimate authority, and they will be. The American Civil Liberties Union, the Gay Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, and the National Center for Lesbian Rights all responded with a joint statement praising the move at HHS. Their statement read, quote, "This decision removes the threshold barrier to coverage for medical care for transgendered people under Medicare. It is consistent with the consensus of the medical and scientific community that access to gender transition-related care is medically necessary for many people with gender dysphoria." Dysphoria. That's right, I said dysphoria. I like saying that word. The National Gay and Lesbian Task Force issued their statement that said, quote, "The dominoes are falling rapidly," unquote. And indeed, I cannot argue with that. The dominoes are falling rapidly. And that's why I'm a little obsessed with this topic. I admit I'm a bit obsessed with it, but I see it as the greatest direct threat to my family and my friends, and so therefore I speak out on it. We've got Bob Gates, former Secretary of Defense, telling the Boy Scouts that it's time for them to not only let in homo youth, but it's time for them to let in homo scoutmasters. And he says, I would have supported having homosexual scoutmasters, but I fully accept the decision that was democratically arrived at by the Boy Scouts before I took over. But believe me, by the time the door hits Robert Gates in the backside as he's on his way out, I can assure you that the Boy Scouts will indeed have been forced to bring in the homosexual scoutmasters. There's no doubt about it. That's Bob Gates' mission in life, is to homosexualize the Boy Scouts. A report from the Daily Caller, Adam Carolla isn't backing down from his recent claim that the gay community in Hollywood acts like a mafia, demanding everyone apologize for every joke and retract every statement. Here's what Adam Carolla has to say. He says, you get out there as a comedian, you make a joke about, you know, you fill in the blank, sexuality, sexual proclivities, whatever it is, and the gay mafia will come after you. That's great. Adam Carolla, a crotch humorist on the order of Jimmy Kimmel, is now considered a spokesman for some kind of conservatism. You people are pathetic. I've heard conservative talk show hosts interviewing this person as if he's someone, as if he's one of us, a conservative. Adam Carolla, did you see? He says, well, you make a joke about, you know, you fill in the blank, sexuality, sexual proclivities. He doesn't say anything else because that's all he makes jokes about, is sexuality and sexual proclivities. That's his entire act, is to make sex jokes. Anyway, he says that this homosexual mafia is sort of stifling, says Adam Carolla, crotch humorist. I guess he's depressed that now he'll have to limit his jokes to heterosexual only. Disgusting, Adam Carolla. Jay Carty is resigning as the White House press secretary. He's leaving his post soon. Let's see. He's going to be replaced by communications deputy Josh Earnest. Josh Earnest. Now, no offense to anyone out there who's named Josh, but in a common American colloquialism, to Josh someone means to, you know, to lie. His name is Josh Earnest. And it just strikes me as, well, etymologically entertaining. I like words. I think his name, his title should be Earnest Josher. Earnest Josher, Josh Earnest. Take the podium, and we'll move on from that. The bike share program in Baltimore has been canceled because 40 bikes were stolen. They can't do bike share. They had to cancel it. That's because you can't have a program that relies on the honor system in a culture that has abandoned honor. The younger generations don't know how to share because they've been robbed of their relationship with their creator by adults who are barreling headlong into hell, and they want to take as many of us as they can with us. But we will resist here at The Worldview. And thank my friends at KGOV.com and American Right to Life, my other brother Darryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. And should the Lord tarry, I'll return next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.